Yeah, and welcome to the Show Me History Show. This is brought to you by myself, Dave, and my friends Bill and Jim. Let me just adjust their headsets real quick. Is that better, guys? There we go.
Yeah, I got you.
I need my head adjusted frequently.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are sitting here gossiping the whole time. I got to up until the last second and a half to get them on the air.
We're talking lemonade and whiskey, and now he wants to do a show.
It's kind of rushing in there. Yeah, so this is a show we do irregularly about history from a Missouri perspective, and we were talking last time about the history of the Mormons and the Wild West. And, you know, I think we kept it reasonably
we were good.
Nice. Yeah, we didn't maybe offend anyone, or I think we were okay.
I don't know.
I didn't have any.
Where else?
I didn't have any knocking on my door.
So. They weren't listening, maybe.
Hey, you want me to kick this thing off?
Yeah. Why don't we start? And so yeah, we kind of made some progress on that. And I think then we were going to maybe finish and then get into some of the actions with the Mormon battalion.
Yes. Well, you know, let's in rehashing where we came from, which is what I'd like to do, is you'll remember that in Missouri we had an extermination law on Mormons, extermination, not removal. Extermination, and that was on the books all the way until Kit Bond came in as a governor. Well, it was 1970 something. Yeah, so bottom line is we ran all the Mormons out of Missouri, and we ran them to Nauvoo, Illinois. And we talked about that, you know. Well, sure enough, when they got to Nauvoo, Illinois, it didn't take very long, and people started looking at them and saying, what? They do what? They believe what? What are their... Wait a minute.
Yeah, and that was kind of funny to where they were like, we can't believe what happened to you guys in Missouri. You're welcome here. Yeah. So that's terrible. And then suddenly they're like, okay, we're starting to see why the Missourians were irritated. All of a sudden they
think, and more of them kept showing up. There was the problem, you know. It was like, you know, if there's 10 of them, that's one thing. But when you got, gosh, thousands of them showing up and building their temples and all that, you're like, oh, good grief.
Well, the problem was we talked about they start to dominate the population.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And they vote like a monolith, right? So they're voting locally, and they put their own judges and their own county commissioners in and all that stuff.
Well, then you get the Smith boys who created this that say, wait, no, we don't like the way it's going.
Right.
And then they make a big division in their own circle.
Yep.
It just gets to be a bigger mess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so, as we know, they did the Smith boys in, you know, the bunch of vigilantes surrounded the jail. And now all these Mormons are standing there going, what do we do now? And up steps none other than Brigham Young. And Brigham Young, he realizes we got to get the heck out of Dodge. But the problem is you've got to turn around and get all these people out of there. And the only place they saw that they might stand a chance would be to head way west. I mean, beyond Missouri, all the way out to this new place that they'd read about in this little handbook that John Fremont had put together about the Oregon Trail.
What isn't John Fremont responsible for?
Oh, yeah. Well, there you have it. You know,
nothing. Yeah. His wife was.
That's right.
So his wife has her fingers in a lot of pies.
She's the one that needs a statue in the Capitol.
That's right. You know?
But they decided there's this big salt lake out there in this new territory, and they said, well, it's so far out there, nobody will ever mess with us. So we'll create our own nation, if you will. They were going to call it Deseret. And the only problem they have is they don't have the money to do it. I mean, it cost a lot of money. A lot of people didn't realize back then, even those that, you know, traveled by boat or by rail to get to St. Joe, Missouri and jump on a wagon train, it would cost a lot of money to outfit, you know, just a wagon and your mules to pull it or whatever, you know, oxen, along with, you know, hooking up with one of these groups that would guide you. It was a fortune. And, I mean, not everybody could do it. And so here's the Mormons are sitting there. They didn't even have the equipment they needed. Most of them had little hand carts, you know, like the old Monty Python days, bring out your dead. That's what they had.
Sure.
And so, but they still need supplies. I mean, you know, you're talking 1,000 people, you know, a couple of thousand people heading out that way. How are you going to do it? And so what happens is this most bizarre situation takes place. We had the church leaders sent a guy by the name of Jesse Little, a leader of one of the branches of the church, into the eastern United States to ask for government assistance. Now, can you imagine? Here we are. We're in 1846, and we're already talking government assistance, folks, you know. And so here we have a group of people that were on the extermination list who have basically told the government, stick it, we're not going to live by your laws or do anything. We live by church law, so on and so forth. We don't recognize your judges, nothing else. But now they're in a predicament. And so what do? They turn to the government. And they said, you know, we would like to turn around and have the government help us. And if you will, we'll pack our stuff and we'll disappear out west. Which seemed like a, you know, all right, that's one way of getting rid of them, right? Now, before Little had arrived in Washington, D.C., the U.S. Congress had declared war on Mexico. The Mexican-American War breaks out. And President Polk, like in any military situation, they're looking to recruit forces to head down and fight in Mexico. Now, believe it or not, a huge number of the people, and we've talked about this, that volunteered to fight in the Mexican-American War were Missourians. Bear in mind, we're the jumping-off point, and we are West. And so what happens is that, you know, we had a lot of Missouri boys fighting that war, but very quickly, President Polk realizes, I need more people, and I need more soldiers. Well, this guy Little from the church says, perfect opportunity. We've got people already in, you know, western part of Illinois. Some of them are still straggling around up in Iowa. And we can pull together, you know, a huge battalion of force. We can get you 500 men tomorrow. And the idea being is that in doing so, he would gather together his Mormon troops and they would fight for the United States government. Now, bear in mind, they are not patriots. They're not in this, you know, because they believe in fighting a war. Their whole thing is if we join up with the military, they'll give us like $45 a man for clothing allowance, and then they'll pay us a salary every month. And the idea being is it's just simply a missionary thing for these guys. They are going to join the military, take their clothing allowances, and they're going to give it to the church so that the church can buy what they need to get everybody else out of Illinois and out. It's a funding program to get everybody else to Salt Lake City.
Okay.
And so here these guys are join up, and supposedly they had negotiated a deal that they wouldn't see any combat, you know, and they said, you know, we won't send you the front lines, but we are going to ask you as you're heading out west to help build roads out there and all that kind of stuff and everything. So they signed up. So, you know, that kind of sets the stage for you where this Mormon battalion comes from. But, you know, I find so fascinating about the story is they're not in it for the sake of fighting for the United States government. They're in it to get the money so that they can get the heck away from the U.S. government, which, you know, is kind of an interesting twist in itself.
Well, it's survival.
Yeah.
We can't do this as we stand now. We've got to have something to back this up with. We need resources. And here is the federal government, the same as we are now. Let's just hand out money.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
We're in this war in Mexico that we really don't need to be involved in. But by golly, we're going to.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it interesting when I've read, in the way I interpreted the Mexican-American War, we were going to take over the whole peninsula of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went, oh, wait, now we've got it. We really, really don't want it.
Yeah.
I've never quite grasped what happened in the hallowed halls of Congress or in the White House. They said, wait, why do we do this? Why do we need to keep this?
Well, and you bring up a great point in that, you know, there's so much territory there. And understand that at the time, Mexico had, you know, basically Texas all the way to Oregon, you know, in Nevada, all Arizona, all of that. Well, it was the people there were Mexicans, you know, and so, you know, we're talking about winning this war. We're going to assume all of the people and all the territory in the western part of the United States. Well, bear in mind, we're talking prior to the Civil War, and Congress, in making their decisions, are saying, Well, good God, you know, we took Texas and you could have divided that into four states and upset the balance of power. There'd be more southern states than northern ones. And so all the decisions are also have that hanging over their head. Think about it. If we took over the entire Mexican peninsula, then how many states could be created? Well, one of the arguments that the southerners made is say, well, if we just take the western part of the United States as we know it now, you know, that's that will give you, you northerners can have that part. We'll take the whole southern part, every what is now Mexico. And they figured we can sit there in the Congress room and divvy it all up and come up with an equal number of states in Mexico and an equal number north of the border, and then everybody walks away happy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're playing Monopoly already.
Yeah, and we've got to factor in the French, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
they had a huge interest in it. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, we might have messed up.
Yeah. You think?
You know, if they had went on down to the Panama Canal or the Isthmus of Panama like was intended, mm-hmm. all this that we're going through now would have been a moot point.
Right, right.
And we'd have had resources and all kinds of things, but, you know.
Yeah, hindsight's 20/20.
It is. It yes. really is.
You know, but I've flown over Mexico. I know a lot of our listeners have, and you look out the window and you think, dear God, I mean, there's nothing down there, you know, and that's now. So you can imagine in the 1840s, you know, when people said, you know, we'll take over Mexico. Well, aside from Mexico City and Veracruz, I guess it is, that they there's nothing there. No. I mean, it's so, you know, a lot of people were questioning what in the world would we do with it if we had it. And it this rolls over into a huge issue that I think is kind of fascinating in that what happened is that war, you can draw a lot of parallels between that and the Vietnam War.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
There were so many people that were totally opposed to this war. And, you know, just for that reason, they're saying, what in the world are we even thinking about trying to take this? What are we going to do with it when we have it? Why are we doing this?
Right.
And even people like Emerson and Thoreau, Longfellow, all of the great writers of the time, they came out in opposition to this war as well.
And they thought it was a land grab. Right?
Yes, just yes.
And, it was.
And they were all pissed off about people were being taxed for it.
Yeah.
And they literally were, you know, I'm not going to give you a dime of my taxes to go fight on a war to grab a bunch of desert.
Yeah, well, a desert also overrun by thousands of Comanche Indians.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, exactly.
I mean, it could be argued that Mexico actually made out pretty well with what it gave up because, yeah.
right.
you know, I mean, the Texas province and the New Mexico had kind of been a real headache for them for resources for a long time. And the Comanche were really starting to dominate those areas and raid all through. I mean, most of the ranchos at this point were like depopulated because no one would even live out there because you were constantly getting raided by Comanches.
Well, and I think you can speak to this for us, being the former L.A. detective. Just, you know, you think, oh, well, that was old ancient stuff, you know. No, look at the news just a few weeks ago when you had the people rioting in the streets of L.A. and they were, you know, carrying their Mexican flags. And I remember them interviewing some of these rioters who were saying, we're just asking for our land back that was stolen from us. Because
okay.
bear in mind, that yeah, that land out there, and I'm talking Arizona, well, you go ahead. You know as much as I do on that, you know, and that we took Arizona, Nevada, all that whole area. It was Mexico, and we took it by force.
Right. I mean, in the idea that Mexico was also, Spain was a colonial power that mm-hmm. took it from other people who right. also took that from other people. You know, I mean, the Comanche had basically chased the Apaches completely out. I mean, they were, they just enjoyed and got a lot of pleasure out of just hunting down and driving all the Apaches out of all the areas wherever they could find them, you know. And so they were raiding almost like 200-300 miles deep into what we know of Mexico now. You know, just they were cutting a swath across that area that was just. And so part of the deal that the Mexico signed with the U.S. was you have to get the Comanches under control. That's your problem now. And so the U.S. is like, yeah, that's fine. I mean, look, they didn't realize what they were getting off on with that
right.
either.
Right, so. Right. Yeah, but I was when I was watching the news the other night and saw that where they're running around with their Mexican flags and asking for their land back, I thought, yeah, it's too bad my buddy Dave isn't out there as a cop still, you know. I said, what are you going to do with this guy with this Mexican flag, you know, throwing rocks at you? You know, you're thinking, hold on to your flag. You'll come in handy when I get you off the plane and drop you back off in Mexico. You know, I mean.
Hats and bats. Old cop tune. Yeah. Hats and bats time.
Yeah, throwing rocks at people. I think I'd do a little bit more than that to them, but yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Maybe we made a bad deal, too, and not saying, well, that area over there on the coast, you guys keep it.
Yeah.
That place you know is the Angels. It's all yours.
Well, they want it back.
I mean, California actually has been pretty productive for the United States, I think, as far as a territory. A lot of resources.
Yeah.
So.
And still is. It's just, you know, the politics out there are so convoluted.
Well, you know, I mean, I'll be honest. This is what we do. We always digress. But, you know, when I moved out to Los Angeles in 1997 to be a police officer, of course, having never lived in a city before, I was going to now be an LAPD officer in the second biggest city in the country.
Craziest person I've ever met.
I always lived in small towns. You know, Pete Wilson was the mayor, or the governor, I'm sorry, of California. He was a Republican.
Yeah.
I mean, California had Republican governors, and it was not a necessarily Democrat state. But the problem was with the decline in the defense industry, the fall of the Berlin Wall, what really kept a lot of those Republican voters in California was the defense industry, because they tried to, you know, they tended, and there were a lot of military installations in California, Fort Ord, the Presidio, you know, a lot of air bases. Yeah. So you had a lot of veterans and a lot of retirees, and, you know, down in San Diego, these areas were like Republican strongholds. Yeah. And, you know, over the years, I mean, they voted a couple other Republican governors in during those times.
Yeah.
And even in the 2000s, they were voting referendums to not give illegal aliens driver's licenses, it's only been in like the past 10 years that the state has veered off to such an extent. It really wasn't like that when I lived there.
I think we're not giving the state credit, because if you look at the valley, you look at the agriculture area, it's still heavily Republican. It's still heavily conservative.
Right. Yeah, the problem is now, though, that it used to be that Northern California around San Francisco was very liberal.
Yeah.
But L.A. generally was conservative. San Diego, Orange County were conservative, San Bernardino. So that whole Southern California area was actually pretty conservative. And they would kind of balance each other out, the two, Northern versus Southern California. The problem is Southern California in the past, you know, like I said, decade has gotten much more liberal as time's gone on. Yeah. So, because a lot of those people moved out.
Sure.
You know, a lot of those voters left because they didn't have defense jobs anymore. You know, I mean, they built like the Challenger program, the space shuttle program was all built up in L.A. County and Northern L.A. County.
You know, it's like I've talked a lot on a lot of my shows, is that it's the vacuum. And so when you have people move out, and at the very same time, like you're saying, you got people moving out, you have this huge influx of immigrants, Hispanic population with the sanctuary cities, and now, sure enough, you know, this is what you get. When you get the vacuum, it's always a matter of who fills that space.
You know, it's interesting, because there were times where I was, you know, I'm a police officer, and so you'd be testifying in court, and I worked in the valley, like the San Fernando Valley. I worked in fast divisions generally, like Wilshire Division was my first division.
Oh my God.
Wambaugh, that was Wambaugh's division at the Blue, the New Centurions and the Thin Blue Line. And then I transferred to Van Nuys, which was considered the fast division in the valley. And, you know, I didn't live, I mean, I lived in like a nice area, not where I was generally policing, but, you know, you'd get and testify, and like, the jury would be there, and you're an officer and you're in uniform, because back then we actually wore our uniforms when we testified. Yeah. And you know, the defense would always make allegations, like kind of insinuating that maybe you planted evidence. So you did. Yeah. I just wanted to turn to the jury and just say, like, I don't really care what you do with this guy. I don't live in this neighborhood. Like, if you want to let this guy back out of the street, yeah, I'm getting back out of my car, yeah, and I'm driving 30 minutes on the freeway. I'm going back to my house.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have a vested. Right. And that's what I always thought was crazy, because when you'd hear, like, I was in LAPD when we had Rafael Perez and the whole Rampart scandal, yeah, where they were planting guns and dope on people. I was always like, what? There's enough guys running around with dope and guns. Like, you have to plant them on people now? Like,
you're not very good at your
job. I'm not that invested in making it. Or even like when you see on Cops where the guy's got crack cocaine, yeah, and he slips it in his mouth. And so the cop will, some of these cops would reach into their mouth and start trying.
Not going
to
happen.
I'm like, never, ever doing that. No arrest is worth putting my hands in a crackhead's mouth.
I was actually offered a job with LAPD back in the 90s. And come on to this kind of the backward way. I'd been at a conference, and there was three different LAPD guys there, and we started hanging out and talking over that week. And one said, yeah, we need help.
Oh, my God.
We're going to get you. You need to just say, yeah, you'll do it, and we'll have you a job by Monday morning.
Oh, my God.
Like, so what's the gig here?
Yeah.
Well, it finally come out that they had it in their mind, if I would move there, that would leave a job opening here, and one of them was going to take it.
Little switcheroo.
Little that's switcheroo, smart. Like, no, yeah. I'm happy here in the sticks.
I'd just stay right here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So off on a tangent that we went, but bottom line is we're talking about the fact that establishing the fact that what we consider the desert Southwest, all of those states, those were all up for grabs in this Mexican-American War, which puts us back to where we've got these volunteers from the Mormons that decide they're going to join up get the money.
Yeah, it seems surprising to me that with as many volunteers as they were having for the volunteer units, I mean, I think at some points they were telling units, no, we don't need any more, you know, because you had the U.S. regulars. And then they were going to supplement them with like the Mississippi Rifles, right, and other units that were getting raised. And at some point they had to kind of put the brakes on the enthusiasm because it had been a while since there'd been a war. And so, you know, kind of like anybody who was in the military was excited. This was, you'd been putzing around in the Army for 20 years and now you suddenly have a chance to see some action and make rank, right?
Well, and here again, that's a great point. And one of the things I was thinking is that, okay, so the battles are taking place down at, you know, along the border, the southern border as we know it now.
Initially, yeah.
But you have this group where you have the population is a huge percentage Hispanic because it was part of Mexico. And so I wonder if a lot of that wasn't the idea of, you know, okay, we know we're going to win this thing, but then once we win it, we're going to have to deal with this huge population. And I know that, again, here's our buddy Fremont. He heads out there, and part of his responsibility was to stir the pot. And while the war is going on to the south, he comes to California to gather as many followers as he can to create what they call the Bear Flag Rebellion,
right,
which in essence was to get the people in California who weren't of Hispanic background to join up and cause another front. And so
it's kind of like Texas all over again.
Yeah.
The Mexican government says, okay, you can come live here, but you can't like try to start rebellions. Or, oh, no, we won't do that. And the second they get in, they do the exact thing they said they weren't going to do.
I got to wonder if part of this Mormon battalion thing wasn't as a, I don't want to call it a peacekeeping force because it wasn't, they didn't have peace yet, but I almost wonder if it was a stabilizing force. That and the other thing, I read some of the diaries of some of the people that went. And on this, you know, joined up and did this, and it was a lot of it where they were told that it was because they were able to deploy ahead of other people back east because, again, we're at a stage here where you're not taking a train west.
Yeah.
You're not, and to send boats, you know, God, you had to go all the way around the southern tip of South America.
Well, I mean, and Bill mentioned, you know, the fact that, you know, why didn't they take more take all of Mexico. I don't necessarily think Mexico would have agreed to a deal where they were going to give up their entire country. But also the problem is, I don't think the U.S. was interested in getting in large bodies of Mexican populations and then trying to integrate them into the U.S. I mean, the areas they pretty much wanted were pretty sparsely populated, especially thanks again to the Comanche. A lot of people who had lived there had fled.
Well, yeah, and you know, this is before the age of the gold rush.
Yeah,
the silver that had been found in places like Colorado and all, there wasn't anything there other than good chance an Indian's going to kill you or you'd die of the elements. And I just can't quite even put my arms around the idea of, okay, let's say you are at the farther west end of this whole mess, and you're, well, let's just take Nauvoo. You're going to set off, say goodbye to the wife and kids, and you are going to walk 2,000 miles. 2,000 miles. I've watched people circle the parking lot at Hy-Vee for an hour trying to find a spot closer to park. Can you imagine if they came to you today and said, you're going to San Diego and you're hiking?
Well, you know what's crazy? You know, the reason that I'm aware of the Mormon Battalion is because in Los Angeles, there's a giant bas relief monument to the Mormon Battalion. Mm-hmm. I want to say it's the biggest military bas relief. Bas relief, that's how you pronounce it?
Bias.
Yeah, so in the country for military purposes. And it's dedicated to the Mormon Battalion. And it's on the side of where I guess they built a fort in Los Angeles when they got to Los Angeles. Spoiler, folks. Apparently, they got to Los Angeles. But, yeah, so I would walk by it. I'd have to park my car and walk to work, and I'd always hike up the hill and look at this thing. I'd be like, what the heck? What is this thing doing in the middle of here? The Mormon Battalion? Like, and it's huge, and it's like it got a giant fountains and stuff.
Really?
Of course, it was Los Angeles, so the thing was completely broken, run down, and had homeless people sleeping all over it.
Oh,
but,
my God.
But they recently did renovate it. So
really?
Maybe like 10 years ago.
I read somewhere where it was the, and you guys probably know, it was the longest military expedition in the history of the U.S. military.
The
2,000-mile hike. You know, we can do it in a B-2 in whatever, 20 hours now, halfway across the world. But like I say, I think people have a tendency to not put into perspective, you know, we're not talking that long ago. You know, you're talking 150 years ago. And the idea that to get from point A to point B, you know, I mean, I can't even imagine walking home from here tonight.
Well, I mean, General Price ran away from Missouri all the way to Mexico after the war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's pretty far, too.
Yeah,
but he had motivation.
Well, yeah, when somebody's shooting at you.
If you've seen General Price, too, you don't want to be that horse he rode on.
No.
Yeah, that's right.
We keep calling these Mormons volunteers.
Uh-huh.
I don't think they truly were volunteers. Yeah, I think the way the church is structured and the hierarchy of it, they said, well, gee, you don't want to go? Well, too bad you're going.
Yeah, they had truly a come-to-Jesus meeting
with
Brigham Young, who said,
come to Joseph Smith meeting.
Yeah, and you know, in some of those things I saw, in those diaries I was reading, they went off on this thing, and they must have done a really good job, Brigham Young and them, because they were doing God's work. That, you know, even though they were not to go and fight, but the God's work was that they had been chosen, these 500 guys, to raise the money to create, you know, keep the church alive and get them remotivated and headed out to Salt Lake. So they were honestly under the belief that their pay was, it was like a missionary thing, that they were saving the church, that, you know, God is looking down on them as being the saviors of the church because it was on its last legs and on its knees coming out of Nauvoo.
So part of the deal was they were going to check out Salt Lake City, the Salt Lake area, to see if that was, is that the idea on
no,
the way?
No. Their thing was, is they already knew where Salt Lake City was, but they didn't have the money for everybody else, for their families and everybody to get there.
So had they already been established in Salt Lake City at that point?
No, hadn't been there yet.
It was just a lake.
They just didn't have, they'd read about it in Fremont's book, but they decided that's where they would go, but they didn't have the money to get there.
Okay.
They were flat.
But my question is, on the expedition, do they pass through?
No. They go to the southwest from Iowa, Kansas, Iowa, Missouri border. And they were paid a whopping $42 for the year.
Yeah.
Now, that didn't go in the family's pocket. That went to the church general fund.
Yeah. Who then decided, you know, here's what we're going to buy in the way of wagons and supplies and that sort of thing.
Good old Brigham wrote a letter.
Yeah.
And it, to the saints living in Garden Grove, Kansas, the president wants to do us good and secure our confidence. The outfit of this 500 men costs us nothing, and their pay will be sufficient to take their families over the mountains. There is a war between Mexico and the United States to whom California must fall a prey. And if we are the first settlers, the old citizens cannot have a Hancock or Missouri mop pretext to mop to the saints. This saying is from above for our own good.
Hmm. And so, yeah, he's...
Does he go on the trip?
Are you kidding me? No. Brigham is staying put, and he's got Rockwell Porter, the avenging angel, right there beside him.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Classic, the assassin.
Classic leadership.
Yeah, it is.
How the generals work, yes, you know, in headquarters, you know, take that hill. But, yeah, I bear in mind, the bulk of them are in Nauvoo. Well, they got to get to Salt Lake City. Guess what, folks? They ain't going through Missouri.
No.
You know, that in itself is going to cause a hardship, and that expedition is actually going to have to head up through Iowa, I think,
because when they left Nauvoo, not all of them did. Some of them stayed. They went over on the Iowa border and stayed on the Missouri River on Indian land.
Yeah.
And then set off from there. Some of them went down into Kansas right along the border, and that was the kickoff from where the Mormon Battalion left.
Yeah.
And started the long march.
Yeah. But again, you know, with the stories we've told you about these Mormons, you got to be thinking, oh my goodness, you know, here you are. I can't even run away through a state that's, you know, they've got an standing execution order on us. So you're going to have to take a detour here. So I'm going to go and sign up for the very government that is, you know, part of this, you know, this state is part of, that has a standing execution order for me, but I'm going to be a part of their military, in essence. You know, I just, the whole thing seems so bizarre to me.
And did they give them, like, ranks? Like you're a captain of volunteers? Or?
No, okay. Not even the leaders.
No.
They served under the behest of the leaders in the Army.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so.
Yeah. So what was their assignment?
Get to San Diego.
That was it.
Okay. Yeah.
Nothing more.
Right, right. And off they go, hiking away, which, again, you know, they have to take this circuitous route. You know, they kind of launched out of Kansas and then head south, you know, basically, I would say, primarily along the old Santa Fe Trail, kind of that way, and then wind up in, Bill, you know more than me, with Tucson, and, yeah, I mean, it's a god-awful trip.
Yeah.
And they're on foot. Bear in mind, I can't emphasize this enough. There are no roads. There are no quick shops along the way. You can't stop and get a slushy. There's absolutely nothing out there. And one of the biggest issues, from what I understand, was water. There is no water.
I've been over that country where the unknowingly, as I was researching, I've been there.
Yeah.
It's dry.
Yeah, well, I was reading these horror stories from these guys. It makes for some interesting reading when they're talking about they would take willows where they could find a marsh or something, and they would literally suck this swampy water up. A huge number of them died on this trip just because of the water. They said that, in a lot of cases they would, you know, suck the bugs out and spit them out off to the side as they're drinking the water. As the horses would go through the swamp, where, you know, it was just swamp area, everywhere the horse's hoof was, they would, guys would lay down and start sucking the water out where the hoof was. I mean, yeah. And then they had, they'd take like willows and up into the rocks and stick it down between rocks to try and suck whatever moisture was there. I mean, we're talking bad, really bad, you know. And, you know, what is it to say an army moves on its stomach? Well, you know, there is no food, there is no water, and they're hiking 2,000 miles. I mean, it's, if nothing else, your monument in L.A., I'd put a monument up for these guys too.
Oh yeah.
I mean, these are some hard dudes. You know?
Not just guys. Each company was allowed laundresses.
Yeah.
And they even took some children. Now only 5 women finished the trip. But they had 33 women that started out.
So they lost 28 women on the trip?
Who said, "Are you nuts? We're going home."
Oh, so they just quit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not like you're walking to the grocery store. I mean, turning around and going back is maybe more dangerous than just finishing it up.
Well, and you know, if you've traveled down there at all, I mean, you can get on a little rise that's 3 foot high and look off, you know, 70 miles, yeah. And it's all the same, and it's all nothing but scrub brush and sand and just, I mean, I just can't even imagine. I can't comprehend it.
When you look at the maps, they did utilize the Santa Fe Trail quite a bit, too.
Yeah.
In the early part of the trip. But then you get past Santa Fe, and you're down there start getting in the true deserts, and you find things like teddy bear cholla, which is a cactus. And all you got to do, a cholla can be, I swear to goodness, can be within a mile, and it'll look at you and go, "I'm going to go get that guy." And they stick in. To give you a clue, I've got leather hiking boots. They're pretty heavy duty. And I touched one just with the side of my boot. It stuck into the leather.
Oh, man.
And not only that, they have this little happy thing of breaking the spine off when you try to get them off. Now, that was in leather. Can you imagine being in whatever garments they had? I'm sure they were hand-woven. And having one of those things get embedded in you? It's inhospitable.
Yeah. I mean, I just, again, you know, and you're doing this for $42.
So how long did it take them to do it?
Well, we'll get to that.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to rush you guys.
Yeah, no.
I didn't know.
Yeah, let's hang on that. Yeah. I was just, because we got a battle to get to.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Yeah.
There was a battle.
Because there is a war going on.
Well, let me give you just a little more about this water thing. I just found the quotes that I was looking for. You know, out of desperation, the battalion, they often relied on contaminated water sources. Some strained water through their teeth to keep back the live as well as dead insects and the mud from being swallowed wholesale. And after quenching their thirst, they filled their canteens out of the track of the oxen and mules. So a lot of people just simply laid down and lapped it like a dog. Any other company under like circumstances would have mutinized, said the colonel who was in charge of them, and they just kept going. He said, you know, their feet, like you said, their feet became raw. As we tramped on through the sands, we became so weak it was almost impossible to keep our ankles from striking together as we walked, and our hard and dry shoe tops would cut our ankles till the blood came. Many became so weak during the march that they had to leave the battalion, reducing the total number from 500 to 300. Okay, so again, you can see the hardship was unbelievable. And, you know, again, throughout this whole thing, these diaries, they're saying, but I'm doing God's work. That, you know, this is for my church first and my family second. And so, you know, you got to hand it to them. These are devout, you know, followers of the faith. And they firmly believe that, you know, here's one quote, "God be praised for his protection over us according to the word of his servant and prophet."
Yeah, so, I mean, and just so I'm clear and understand this, because the idea is that their religious group would get money based on this service to the country, and that's what they would use to pay for their
travel. Yeah.
Now, what about the people who went back? Do they not get the money?
Well,
I mean, just
it was just the laundresses.
Yeah.
The women.
Yeah.
Oh, so it wasn't other people?
No.
Or people die?
The others are dead.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, but it's going to be a while. The money's still going to roll in, because it's going to be a while before they find out half of them are dead.
Yeah. You know? And it's the federal government.
It is the federal government. Yeah,
I mean, if you die, I think you should still get your money.
Well, yeah. Well, and a lot of them did, because You know, when they set off, it's one of those when they set them off and said, go west, young man. I mean, it's not like you're getting regular radio reports back as to where they're at, the status and where they are. Right. It's anybody's guess. You know, and it, I'm sure there were times out in San Diego where the commanders out there are going, I thought they were going to send us a bunch of Mormons.
Yeah.
You know, where
is everybody?
Where are they? Yeah, yeah. You know, because we're talking literally months and months and months.
I mean, it's almost like this is reminiscent of like one of the Crusades.
Yes.
You know,
it is.
Like
yes.
Where they just go off and you're like, good luck. We hope you guys make it.
That's a great analogy.
The people they're coming to help aren't sure that they want their help, right. But like you don't know what you're getting.
Here's a sharp stick. Go down that way. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and they had a good leader, Philip St. George Cook. And they come to really think he was something else. Career Army, knew what he was doing.
And he's Mormon?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, he is not Mormon.
Because I was going to say, if he's too good a leader, wait up much out. Somebody's probably going to line you up for a jailhouse shooting also.
No, he was regular Army, and the president had put him in charge of this. Now, he was sharp enough, when he got down to New Mexico, he got a new guide. A fellow named John Baptiste Charbonneau.
Hmm. We know who that guy is.
We know who that guy is.
Yeah.
That was Sacagawea's son.
Yes. Yes.
And he had somehow got to New Mexico, I guess got tired of the northern plains, and said, well, I'm going to go somewhere where it's warm. Because up in Wyoming, and I've lived up there, it gets a little chilly in the wintertime. You need an extra pair of socks. So he took them across the continent.
All right, so they had a guide at least.
They had a very good guide, and his daddy had been a guide as well.
Sure. His daddy was Clark from Lewis and Clark fame.
No,
fame,
right? He was Charbonneau, the French guide.
Oh, Charbonneau, yes, okay, yeah, yeah, okay, yeah.
So, you know, here's this kid was raised up. John Baptiste was raised up by a guide who taught, I'm sure, give him every bit of information he knew. And the kid was probably guiding even as a child.
There you go. Yeah.
So
I was getting confused. I was thinking it was Sacagawea's son.
It is. But it is Sacagawea's son.
Did she have more than one baby daddy?
No.
No.
I thought that after Lewis and Clark did their expedition and they came back to St. Louis, that she had given Clark the son to raise in St. Louis.
She did.
Okay. And then
educate, but then he went back out. Oh,
okay.
But he was Charbonneau's biological son.
Oh, okay. Okay, now I'm with you.
Sounds like some drama in the expedition.
You know, see, it's just kind of like even like soap operas.
It is. It's just like reality TV.
But, you know, again, to think about this, I can't even comprehend that mom has hiked all the way out west with Lewis and Clark, come all the way back to St. Louis. This kid's in St. Louis. Then here he is. He's raised and educated there and then hooks back up with the dad. Hooks back up with the expeditions out west. And here he is again, this kid. I mean, think where the dang kid has been. He got carried on his mom's back all the way to California once.
Yep.
Comes back, and now he's going back with the Mormons?
He knows his stuff.
You know, we got a lot of people here who haven't been out of Camden County. It's just
but
amazing.
Think of it this way.
Well, ticks. You got to worry about ticks.
Yeah.
If you had been raised out west and then lived in the west, and then you're injected into St. Louis, wouldn't you go back out west too?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I just was in St. Louis the other month. I think I'd probably go back out there too.
Well, this is a guy that was born and raised in Mexico and goes Mexico, Missouri, and goes to L.A. to be a cop.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of validity to anything you say.
I think I told you guys too. I was at the academy for a month and they had the North Hollywood shooting.
Yeah.
And I was like, I remember sitting in my apartment being like, I didn't realize. I thought this must happen all the time, and I was like, "I'm on a bit off more than I can chew with this big city thing."
I'd love to have been a fly on the wall when you're talking to your parents about how everything's going, son.
Oh, they just had a big giant shootout with some guys in an armored car.
Well, I went out to L.A. to attend a training session, and we went over to the L.A. Police Academy.
Sure. Yep.
And stepped outside one morning. And there was shooting all around out there, like, what the heck is going on? Who is shooting at who in this place?
Was it like the range or something? because they have the range there?
No, it was out in the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, probably. That happens. Yeah.
I mean.
That happens. Very nonchalant. Oh, that happens. Remember, I went through the Highway Patrol Academy, so.
When I was at Wilshire Division, I was working with my training officer, and it was busy. Like I said, it was considered a fast infection. In fact, when I graduated at the academy, I could pick. I graduated first in my class, so the prize you got there was you could pick your division that you're going to go to. And there I picked Wilshire because they said it was the fastest division. And I remember the guy in charge of my TAC class, the OIC, was like, "Where are you going, kid?" And I said, "I'm going to Wilshire Division, sir." He goes, "Keep your head down."
Good knowing you.
That's it. But I was on patrol. I was with my training officer. And, you know, I had friends that worked different divisions. One of my friends had worked West Valley, and he's like, West Valley is like a very quiet suburban division. He was telling me, "Oh, I did these DWI arrests." And I was like, "So you had a year of probation?" I'm like, "Man, I don't know how to do a DWI. We haven't done any of those." So my training officer's there, and I'm like, "Hey, sir, do you think we could ever do like a DWI?" So he looked at me. He's like, "DWI? What are you talking?" He goes, "Half the people driving in this division are DWI. Which one? You pick one.
Pick one, we'll do one."
He goes,
"Right,
don't you
now
think we got better stuff to do than be doing DWI arrests?"
When do we find time to do it there, Troop?
Because his thing, he always would say, "You must be on crack." That's what he'd tell me. I was like, he's like, "Are you on crack, Moppin? You want to do it?" He started laughing. I'm so, I'm just like, "Oh, geez, I just want to make sure everything works out okay."
Yeah. It's one of those where you kind of make your career choice and you think, maybe this wasn't the best one, right?
Yeah, a traffic stop in Wilshire was my training officer telling me, "Lean back in your seat." I'd lean back. He would pull out his gun, point it at the inside of the door at the people. Like, we'd pull up on the left side of them. Yeah. He'd say, "Roll down your window." They'd roll down the window. Meanwhile, he's got his gun pressed up against the inside of the door, right in front of me. And he'd go, "Let me see your driver's license." He would show the driver's license and go, "All right, you're cool. Take off. Oh, bye." My God.
Oh, man.
Sounds like I should have went with him.
I know.
Should have signed up here. Yeah, man.
No, I'd have been like this Mormon battalion. Once I got to San Diego, my number one goal would have been to get back, get the heck out of Dodge, And that is, it's amazing. Like I say, they left in January, and it was well into the following summer, wasn't it?
Well, I guess the route they picked, though, that's good because it's desert, right? So you kind of want to be there when you're avoiding the worst of the heat, right?
Well,
do you ever walk across Kansas in the wintertime?
Yeah, I guess. But nice, I mean, you got a long, it's going to take you a long time. So you kind of got to line it up properly, right? To make sure.
Yeah.
Because the mountains are the problem, too, right? If you try to cross mountains when it's too cold, you got.
Well, and I guess, that was a thing. They were gone for, a year and a half? Yeah. So I guess, they hiked as far as they could till they got to the mountains, and then then turn around and then made the trip in the spring that following year.
So you just take a break right there.
But it's like, May of 1847, and they left in January of 46. So, again, I just can't quite get my arms around the idea of walking out this door, the three of us, and say, "Okay, a year and a half, we're going to go see the monument that Dave's been telling us about."
Well, yeah, so that's an interesting thing, too, because, do the authorities in California know that they're coming? Because how do they get news from that? Like a boat?
They send a dispatch.
Boat's got to come. No Panama Canal, right?
No.
So it's got to go all the way around South America and then come up and pull into port.
But, they're getting dispatches that say, "We're sending a Mormon battalion out there." But again, they're, when they got the dispatch, they probably looked at it and said, "And they're coming on foot."
Yeah.
From Kansas.
Well, it's funny that they would send the dispatch by boat, but they don't let the Mormons take the boat.
Heck no. They're expendable, buddy. So it is. It's just, I just still can't quite get my arms around it.
Well, just the logistics of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Now, they did have a wagon train that went with them, but it didn't last.
No.
So they're out there in the desert foraging. That takes a lot of special thinking.
Yeah.
You're on the plains foraging in the tall and short grass prairies. That takes a lot of especially to what they're used to.
Oh, yeah.
They're used to verdant river valleys.
Well, these guys were in Missouri. They were in Boonville, for God's sakes.
There's a lot of good food around
and
there.
And then they go to the bottoms there at Nauvoo, Illinois, along the Mississippi. The next thing you know, they're, you know, knee-high in Peckerbrush in the middle of God only knows where, and it's 105 degrees with no water. You know, all in all, I think it's going well.
Yeah, and they're walking across the Great Grass Desert, as it was known, mm-hmm. thinking, now, what are we going to eat? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We can't eat this.
Now, is there buffalo?
There are bison, yeah. But, you know, they bison aren't that stupid, as sometimes portrayed, because the bison would go, there's noise over there. Let's just move. Mm-hmm. Now, they did, you know, they had things like prairie dog. They'd kill some prairie dogs, maybe a bird once in a while, but, you know, they didn't have the big deer, vast deer herds like they could have back home, so to say. So it was a difficult journey.
Well, there's 300 of them still. You know, who gets the prairie dog?
Yeah. Prairie dog is not known for feeding a lot of people.
No. Yeah.
No, it wasn't the loaves and fishes type thing.
No.
It's not like the ones on HH. That could probably feed a whole battalion.
I'm telling you, if anything ever happens, just from the top of HH to duck in. I count them sometimes. There's like 12 of them.
They're not small.
No.
Boy, the groundhogs?
Oh, my God.
They're delicious. They are.
Yeah? Yeah? Anything in barbecue sauce. We are Missourians, you know.
That's how you fix them.
Aluminum pan, some barbecue.
It doesn't matter, buddy. Cook it long, slow. It'll be all right.
Raccoon?
Yeah. Possum?
Yeah.
You can do it.
You can do it. Yeah. I've had it.
Yeah.
That's drawn a very thin
exactly,
line.
Not exactly a delicacy.
No, no.
It can be done.
Buzzard. I did read. Now, this wasn't necessarily the Mormon Battalion, but turkey vultures. They'd shoot those.
Yeah.
And I can't quite get myself there.
No, no.
So I'll admit to, I've just ordered in another big batch of crickets to eat.
Oh, God.
They're delicious.
People, do you understand what I'm doing here?
573-746-8020, folks.
You realize the people I'm working with right now.
573-746-8020.
Completely out of his mind, you know, leaves Missouri to go out there as a cop. I got the other one eating crickets. I mean.
You're in trouble.
Well, it makes me look good. So tell us some more stories about these guys as they're hiking over.
Well, they had a battle.
You know, somebody told me one time, I was teaching a class, and I said, we got to the end of Civil War, and I said, the Battle of Bull Run. And they said that was a Mormon battle.
It was.
And I was like, what? Well, it turned out this person was Mormon, and they proceeded to correct me in that, well, there were actually two battles of Bull Run. Mine was insignificant, you know, that little one that they had in the Civil War, you know, back east. Well,
the Civil War had two.
Well, yeah. Yeah. So tell us about the Battle of Bull Run.
Well, they get into Arizona on the San Pedro River, and they encounter some wild cattle. And the wild cattle said, you got some cattle too. And the bulls, being bulls, said, let's go over and see what they got.
Uh-oh.
And they caused destruction to some of the mules and the wagons and resulted in two men being wounded. So the battalion loaded their guns and attacked the charging bulls, killing 10 to 15 of the wild cattle. And it was known as the Battle of the Bulls.
Now,
well, I mean, if you're hungry, I think that's a pretty fortunate battle to get into at that point.
Unless you're one of those two guys that got run over. What now? After this kid told me about this, I thought, you know, 9 times out of 10, I think, well, they're just making stuff up to see if they can stump the old professor. But sure enough, what I heard was that these bulls were like remnants of domesticated cattle that the Spaniards had.
Yeah.
Well, then the Indians go out and they start raiding these, you know, ranches and everything. And a bunch of these bulls got loose and formed a gang, I guess. And they were out terrorizing people. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there were a couple hundred of them, I guess.
I don't know the numbers.
There was a bunch. Anyhow, these damn things would terrorize the countryside. You saw them coming. You locked your doors and went inside, got away from them. And they said it was so bad, and you're my Indian expert, Dave, They said that the Navajo wouldn't mess with them. They said, do not under it, you know, none of this, yeah, you know, stuff. No, don't, quiet, be very quiet. We're hunting rabbits, right? You know, it was one of those kind of deals. If you saw them, they steered the other way. The Navajo were afraid of these things because they would charge, and now they just wreak havoc on everything. And so, lo and behold, here's these poor saps that have already hiked, what, probably 1,400 miles.
Yeah.
They're thirsty as all get out. Their shoes are shot. And, you know, they're every day they're praying to God, and they're saying, please, God, how could it get any worse? And up over the hill comes 100 of these raging bulls.
delicious bulls. That's what I was
like. Oh, my God. But you're right. They did shoot them.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it was beef. It's what for dinner. But then again, you've got the same problem of, okay, you got several dead bulls. What are you going to do with them?
Also, great job, guide. There's one giant herd of crazy bulls in the entire desert. You led us right into
them. That's right. You took us right to them. Yeah.
You don't mess with range cattle.
Yeah.
When I worked for Bureau of Land Management up in Wyoming, that was a safety brief.
Yeah.
Every year.
Yeah.
We'd have these big safety briefs, and that was one of the things that they always brought up. Range cattle.
Really?
Range cattle safety. First time I heard that, I'm going, safety around a cow? What are you talking about?
It's like dealing with a domestic cat and a barn cat, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I found out really quick. I actually got chased around my government truck by an old mama cow that had a calf, and I'd got out to check it out, and she said, we ain't having that. And away we went. And she had in her idea to do some grave bodily harm to me if she could have caught me.
I would have paid admission to seeing that.
Probably gonna milk you.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a truck, one of the trucks there, that bigger trucks, they didn't trade off as much, that had gore holes in the side of it from a bull.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I thought they were joking. They said, oh, no.
Yeah.
And they said, this was right up a whiskey gap and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
I'm not cows are sacred now.
There you go.
I turned Indian that day.
There you go. I love it. So basically, you know, after their big battle, then what happens?
Well, they captured Tucson.
Did they now?
They did. They're walking along, and there was a contingent of Mexican people, of Mexican battalion there, or small detachment, and they were provisional. So that's like, yeah, you were voluntold to be here. Uh-huh. And they got there on December 16th. The Mexicans retreated as a battalion approached. They went, yeah, no thanks. Because you're looking at all these people coming down the pike here, you know, over 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And they're going, uh-uh. Yeah. We're not that interested.
Yeah.
So let's get the heck out of Dodge. And yeah, they did.
And generally, I think the Mexican troops, the rank and file, were not, morale was not super high. They were ruled by a ruling class that was very elite, you know, more Spanish descent.
Yeah.
They might have some good light cavalry, but like most of the Mexican troops were of the close your eyes, fire one volley, and then make a run for it type of thing. they weren't treated well, and as a result, they didn't really like their bosses.
Maybe their reputation preceded them. They said, these are the guys that killed the bulls.
Yeah, that's right. Could have been. Don't mess with those guys.
That's right. Even the Navajo won't mess with them, you know, yeah.
The ironic thing about this, Cook had no intention of doing anything with Tucson or trying to take it. And the detachment just said, yeah, oh, here you go. Come on over here. We take this. Yeah. We don't want it. We're out of here.
Yeah.
But that made the Odom and Piman tribes very happy.
Yeah.
They said, oh, you got rid of those guys, so we're going back in there.
Hell yeah.
Now you go out there and you find out where the Mormons learned about irrigation.
From the Indians.
So Odom and the Piman. I didn't know that until I was reading, like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
They needed that because Salt Lake City is not the most hospitable place on the planet.
No.
And I still question Brigham Young, like, really? This is the best you could do?
Really.
You pitch your people down by a body of water that's highly salinity?
Yeah.
And go, this is it, folks. We're here. Yeah. We're home.
I guess salt had a value too, though, as a commodity. Oh, so yeah. There's some for preserving food.
God, where they were, how are you even going to get it back east to sell it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they're going to sell it to people that are passing through.
Well, that's exactly how they made their fortune, you know. But hell, if they'd have gone just a little further west, they could have hit Lake Bigler, which I had a hard time figuring out what that was. That's Lake Tahoe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is somebody that probably said, you know, this would probably be a nicer place to stop. Well,
they'd have just stopped up in the mountains.
Well, yeah, you're right.
Because that's not a horrible place. The mountains are around Salt Lake City are pretty nice.
Yeah.
And there's fresh water there.
Huh, go figure.
Yeah, walk down to the lake, but live up here.
Yeah, you know.
Pro tip, don't drink water out of the tap in hotels in Salt Lake City.
Okay, all right.
I don't know if it's proved any, but.
Mm. Okay.
Whiskey won't even fix that.
Yeah, you learned something. Cool.
You know, the two fingers of bourbon and put a little water in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it don't work.
No, just stick with the bourbon.
Stick with the bourbon.
All right. I've pretty well been doing that for the past 30 years.
Their bourbon's probably pretty low proof, though, isn't it? In Utah? Don't they have low proof?
They don't even have any.
They don't have it.
Yeah, they don't have it at all.
You can't buy it.
Yeah, again, another reason why I wouldn't want to live there.
But you can get like light beer, right? Like low.
No, I don't
know. I think you get low alcohol beer.
Yeah. There was a point in time that most of Utah, and in modern times, was no alcohol.
Yeah, it's not dry anymore, but there's restrictions to how much proof things can be. You know, like beer can only be a certain percentage, and I think they can do cocktails, but I think the proof is limited as far as. Well, folks, maybe that's for another show.
Alcohol
and history.
Yeah, we could do a good show on that.
Yeah, we could talk about Arkansas and its dry counties. And then as they're getting near the end of the journey, they run across the Temecula Massacre in Temecula, California. And it was a conflict between Mexican government forces and the Luseno tribe. And the Mormons stood guard to prevent further bloodshed. And that's why the people, Luceno, am I saying that right, Dave?
I don't know. I don't know the name. Mm-hmm. But that area is going to be like 70 miles east of where modern Los Angeles is.
Yeah. Okay.
Temecula, that area. That's a town now. Temecula is like wine country now. It's nice.
Yeah.
Mm.
Near Murrieta.
So when the Mormons come up on this battle that's taking place, who are they cheering for?
Well, they got there after it happened, and all they did is just let the I guess that was a native tribe there, Luiseno. They just stood. They said, "Hey, we're going to make sure that the Mexicans don't do anything else, and let the people gather their numerous dead into a common grave."
Okay.
So they're just peacekeeping.
Now, at this point, though, the war has been declared, right?
Oh yeah,
between the U.S. and Mexico.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, the Mormon Battalion's activity seems kind of odd. Like, they're almost on tour. Like, you're supposed to be fighting those guys.
Well, and again, you know, where they're at now on this hike has got me a little, you know, I'm kind of wondering because the war was actually two wars. You had the Mexican-American War where, you know, we're sending down, you know, our largest amphibious assault ever down into Mexico. So that the main thrust of the war is way south. And at the same time, like I say, John Fremont has been dispatched to California to try and stir the pot and creates the Bear Flag Rebellion. So you got to almost wonder, at some point, are they transitioning? You know, when they're in Tucson, are they under more the guidance of the big war?
Well, remember, initial fighting is along the border between Texas and Mexico, right? Is that Zachary Taylor?
Uh-huh.
That's good old Zach. Yep.
So he wins some victories there against, I think, Santa Ana. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, then they're like, well, that's not exactly the plan. Mm-hmm. Well, Winfield Scott's got the great plan to go and actually invade Mexico City, and that's what
they're going to do. Fuss and feathers, they called him. Yeah.
But, initially fighting was all around that border between Texas and Mexico,
but I would think that as they're approaching closer to California, they become more of a support force for the Bear Flag Rebellion.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe them. They kind of like National Guard now that we send out. They take a back seat sometimes and just become a peacekeeping force.
Right.
Don't come over here.
Right.
Go over there. Go right. fight over there.
Yeah.
Just stay away.
Right. But again, you know, how effective of a force can this be after they've hiked 2,000 miles? Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, it's almost, again, they're in it for the money.
Well, by the time they get there, they're, you know, they're into some pretty good country where there is resources they can have. So they're rehabbing and getting their strength back and feeling better about things. And
yeah, this area would have a lot of ranches and you know, ranchers who are kind of neutral, like wealthy Mexican ranchers who actually aren't necessarily against the U.S. coming in and putting in some normal government as far as, I mean, these are areas that have been kind of neglected to a large extent, I think, by the Mexican government. So they're kind of looking to have the rich people are kind of, as long as their lifestyle is not going to change very much, I think they aren't exactly, don't care either way.
Well, and they're, I guess the Mormons basically are walking into a huge transition there in L.A. and San Diego areas in that, you know, they've just had the Mexican government overthrown. And so now, you know, when these guys come in, they've got to be looking at them and thinking, who are they? And,
yeah.
You know, and they are a different bunch, to say the least.
And they arrived in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
January 28th.
There you go.
So that's got to be making people in Southern Cal go, what did you do?
Yeah.
And you guys might not know this, but are people on the West Coast, are they very familiar with who the Mormons are? Or has this been generally just a Midwest issue?
I wouldn't think they would be.
Right? Because it seems like their activity has been very isolated to kind of that upper Midwest area.
Yeah. My question, you know, and it would be interesting to do some research on it, is they're coming in there with their beliefs, and it's their beliefs that have gotten them in the situation they're in Missouri and in Illinois when they're coming up against white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in Missouri and Illinois. Now they're going to be immersed in a culture that's strictly
Catholic
mm-hmm. based on, you know, the fact that the rule of the Mexican government, and that was the, you know, official church.
Missions, and all the missions.
So I would hope that these yahoos would have enough sense to, you know, don't go in there proselytizing, you know, talking about their faith. They probably, and when they got there, I thought it was interesting. Only had 6 months left on their, before they were out. So, you know, if you were smart, you'd go in there and say, what do you want me to do? And I will be a good boy, you know. And they said that they, you know, some of them, you know, they used them for construction of a courthouse. I mean, they were, you know, they're all pretty good craftsmen, you know. They're mm-hmm. so self-sufficient. A lot of them went to L.A., and there they built this fort up there, you know. And,
yeah, it's right near where downtown Los Angeles would be.
Okay, and near the Cajon Pass. How do you say
that? Cajon.
Cajon Pass. Yeah, and this pass, I guess, was the main pass through the mountain, so anybody that was going to come to L.A. was, you know, if you could build the fort there, you could guard it pretty well strategically.
Yeah, it's a Cajon. Yeah.
Okay.
It's near where, not far from where Dodger Stadium is.
Okay.
It's Hill Street. It's on a hill.
Okay.
The street is called Hill Street.
Okay. So yeah.
It's kind of a raised area.
Well, then from what I understand, they, you know, that's what they were doing until they finished up their terms in the military enlistment. And then they started heading back. Now, that in itself, I don't know if that wouldn't be an even better story. Is, you know, when you get there and you're thinking, dear God, you know. How do I get back? Because again, there's still no railroad.
Well,
and even if you took a boat, it's going to take you back. At closest, I guess they could get you would be New Orleans.
I mean, the first time you did it, you didn't know what you were getting yourself into.
Yeah.
When you're going back, you know how bad it is.
I wonder how many of them said, you know, I love you, darling, but California's pretty
this
nice.
Catholicism is looking pretty good.
Well, about 80 of them re-enlisted.
What?
Yeah.
What?
80.
Really?
Re-enlisted.
In the Mormon battalion?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
What about the other ones? What do they do?
They went home.
I just can't even imagine.
22 of them died as a result of the march.
Yeah.
So, you know, they didn't really care one way or the other at that point. We're dead. It don't matter.
Right.
But 80 of them said, let's stay.
Wow.
That's what gets me. they did occupation duties. They, like you mentioned earlier, they did building. They did a lot of things while they were there. 15 of them were selected to accompany Kearney and Fremont back east to his court-martial.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's one way to get back east.
Yep. And during the journey, they went up north and through the Sierra Nevada. They went to one of the campsites where the Donner Party had been.
Wow.
And while there, there were still bodies laying out there in the Sierra. They buried those bodies from the Donner Party.
Really? Wow. So they're everywhere.
They're everywhere.
Well, I stumbled across kind of another interesting tidbit is six of these guys were out there in California waiting for their time to expire in the military. And they were hired by a guy to come and build a mill. And they were there to help build Sutter's Mill, where, lo and behold, they were there when gold was discovered at this mill, you know. And so, you know, and that prompted the famous gold rush of 1849. That's where we get our, you know, San Francisco 49ers, you know. But I think it was interesting in that they found the gold, and you know, the guy that owned the mill tried to keep it quiet. He just wanted to make his money off the mill. He didn't want anybody to know there's gold there because he said, hell, everything will go crazy if it does. And sure enough, it did. But, you know, I wonder if those six guys were some of them that he said, don't you tell anybody that we found all this gold up here, you know.
Well, obviously that didn't work.
No.
It didn't work out well at all.
Somebody
he trusted
lied.
The wrong six guys.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I just can't get over the fact that, you know, then you have to go back, you know, and they said, you know, a lot of them came back and reunited with their families and the fellow saints. One group of about 30 men walked all the way back to Middle Missouri River Valley after discovering that their families had yet to arrive at Salt Lake City. I mean, good grief. You talk about some tough dudes now. I mean, I can't even imagine. Like I say, I see people circling the parking lot in front of Target, and that's too far to have to walk to get in all the way in there. You know, and here you're talking a 2,000-mile hike with attacked by bulls, and no food, no water, and then
teddy bear, show you a cactus.
Yes, and then turn around and say, "I love you, darling. I'm coming back." Oh my God! You know, could you meet me halfway? You know, I mean,
well, no, because halfway is Kansas.
Well, there you go. And here again, I think we need to remember that, you know, at the time of the Civil War, the farthest terminus you could get to on a rail line was Tipton, Missouri. And then you had to get on a Butterfield stage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it wasn't like you could, well, I'm here, I can hop on a jet and be home in 3 hours. You know, and like I say, the other problem you got is, you know, they're there at the coast where they could get on a ship, well, if they could find the money for the passage, but then they got to find their way back to someplace that'd be close. Well, again, I guess the closest you could get to would be New Orleans, but even then you got to sail off. There is no Panama Canal, and, you know, I don't know how many of the ships from California would come to New Orleans, and most of them were headed to the East Coast.
Actually, Texas.
Well, yeah, I never thought about that.
Oh, shoot, I can't think of the name of the city.
Galveston?
Galveston, yes, sir.
Yeah, okay.
That would have been the nearest port.
And then you still got to hike all the way across that damn desert
Texas.
Southwest. Yeah. So, I mean, you got to hand it to these folks, you know. And like I say, it's, to me, this is just another little smidgen of Missouri history. You know, and that's, I think if I could emphasize anything to our listeners, is that for every story, if you dig a little bit, you'll find it's like an octopus. It's got another eight arms. And inevitably, time and time and time again, when you're talking the 1800s, it all leads back to Missouri. Some way or another, there's going to be a story that ties into exactly where we live, folks.
I mean, somebody should write a book and title it Missouri, Birthplace of the Old West.
You're right. That would be great, wouldn't it? Do you know anybody could do that?
I know somebody that has been working on the research, and he's in his fifth year of it, and going, oh, my God, it never ends.
Maybe it's time to put a pen to paper, you know? Maybe you need to do volume one and two.
It's probably going to be that.
Yeah, yeah,
So to recap, they didn't fight any battles.
No.
Nope.
Not one.
Well,
not
the Bulls.
The Bulls.
Okay. Not a one.
Not a one. Yeah.
That was more shopping.
Yeah.
Okay. That was a shopping distraction.
But isn't that just an amazing story? You know, I mean, and it all starts with them settling around Boonville, Missouri, and this group just, you know, my God, you know.
And if we want to step back and look at it in a proper fashion, mm-hmm. they come from a point of religious persecution here in the state of Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
There's no other way to qualify it. That's what it was.
Sure.
We don't like your religion, so let's put out this extermination order.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine in today's times what it would be like?
No.
We're going to execute you if you don't get out of here.
Right.
Because of your religion.
Right.
And then we go, well, but wait a second.
Yeah.
We'll give you money if you go help.
Right. Yeah.
If they hadn't been so destitute, so poor, in such bad shape, they may have said, yeah, ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
But after this, they get to Salt Lake, they get everything set up, then they become very obstinate.
Yeah.
And still are to this day in some respects.
Well, money is power.
It is.
They were in the right place at the right time, that as the Oregon Trail heads west and everybody during this period of time is trying to get to the West Coast because of Fremont's guide of, you know, it's the land of milk and honey to get to Oregon and, you know, Washington State and California, then they're the biggest quick shop on the run. And so, and you know, they go in there, they put their nose to the grindstone. They're planting crops, and like you say, they've learned how to do the irrigation and all, fruit, crops, beef, everything you need, poultry. And here come these wagon trains staggering in, you know, on their last legs, because they're just like this Mormon battalion. They had no idea how far it was. And by the time they had gotten to Salt Lake City, they had jettisoned everything off the wagons, and they're doing everything they can just to survive. And when they get there, here sits these Mormons with literally, you know, the diary that I have of my great-great-great-aunt. She talked about as they came into town, there were fruit stands on both sides of the road. It was like walking into the biggest market that you could ever even imagine. And the Mormons are more than happy to sell them all this stuff, you know. And then another half of the Mormons, they made a fortune because they had jettisoned everything along the trail. These guys were, you know, like Sanford and Son, they'd go back, and, you know, their base operation was in Salt Lake. Well, they'd head back east along the trail, and they're picking up all these precious goods. You know, I mean, you name it was there.
Yeah.
If it was, especially if it was heavy.
Right.
You know, and so then here they have this stockpile of all this great stuff. You know, and they start selling it, you know, and you know, the rest, as they say, is history. But they became a very profitable center in the far west.
Well, and this Mormon battalion did something that's a lasting legacy to this day, and that's the Mormon Trail that goes from Salt Lake on over into California.
There you go.
And that's been the basis of a lot of interstates out there.
Yeah.
So, you know, they did a lot of good things.
Yeah.
Maybe not expecting to, but
right.
They did.
Well, the good thing they did is they survived.
They did. That's beautiful.
And I mean,
yeah,
that's exactly right. That's what's amazing to me is that anybody to go out there and survive during this period of time, you know. And I, you know, again, can you imagine if everybody in Camden County had to up and move to the far reaches of northern Canada and start from scratch? You know, I mean, think about that. It is just staggering when you think about what they were able to accomplish, especially being persecuted every step of the way, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean.
And it did have a lasting effect of persecution because Mountain Meadows Massacre.
Oh, yeah.
When the segment of the Mormon population or a group went out and killed all these people in this wagon train.
Yes.
Women and children, everybody.
Blamed it on the Indians.
Blamed it on the Indians, and I really believe the more I read that, that comes from what they faced here in Missouri.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting even.
It's fair
game.
We don't
trust you.
Yeah. And as I understand it, most of the wasn't that wagon train that they attacked in the Mountain Meadows Massacre, or most of them were Missourians?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So here again, turnabout's fair play. But then, you know, once they established this empire out there, they literally called it a state, a Deseret. And that's where the problems really started, in that they basically, you know, it's one thing to have your faith in your doctrine. It's another thing when you've got people that you know are opposed to it and you keep rubbing it in their face. And in essence, Brigham Young was telling the federal government, they were part of a territory at that time. And they said, we're not going to recognize a territorial governor. We're not going to recognize your courts. We recognize absolutely no authority of the United States over us. Now, bear in mind, this is the same people that had people join up in a Mormon battalion. But once they got big and powerful enough and independent enough, then they just basically, said, we're going to have nothing to do with the U.S. And that's that doesn't fly very well.
No, people get cranky in D.C.
Yes, exactly.
And other things happen in Salt Lake. If you go to Salt Lake, you will see seagulls highly represented there. And there's a big monument. I believe it's right down by the temple, I think. But it's a tall pillar, and it's got a seagull perched on top of it. And how that come about is they had crops, a lot of crops there, and they were being hit by locusts one year. I mean, just, it was decimating. Starvation was a true problem. And the people went to temple, they prayed. Then all of a sudden, all these seagulls come in and started eating the locusts. And that become one of their big symbols of, hey, we prayed, it happened. So it just underscored their feelings of we did the right thing at the right time.
Yeah.
And this is where we need to be and where God loves us.
Yeah.
So there's other stories that we could talk about, but I don't remember all of them right now.
Right.
But there was a lot of stuff that happened that you go, okay, well, maybe you're on to something here, because that's kind of odd that you would have this happen.
Well, again, to have that kind of devotion,
Oh, and they are very devoted people.
And like I say, to turn around and be that 500 that signed up for the military because you're doing God's work.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how many devoted, any religion today would be willing to do that.
Well, and they even said that the lack of deaths on the march was due to the prayers.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's something to sit back and think about and ponder and have an existential crisis. And
Yeah. Pretty fascinating story.
It is. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah.
There's so many fascinating stories.
Yeah.
We've got one I'd like to get into one of these days. The bloodiest 47 and a half acres in Missouri.
Okay. Yeah. We could definitely do that.
We had another one we were going to talk about next.
Well, we're going to do, Missouri Brigade.
Yeah.
Missouri Brigade.
In the Civil War.
All right. Great. Sounds good to me.
I like when I talk about the honeybee wars, and Dave looks at me like, what are you talking about?
There you go.
I don't know. I mean, Missourians seem like they'll get into wars about just about anything.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dipping cows or whatever.
You name it. Yeah.
All right, gents, you guys got anything else you want to add before we finish up?
I think it's been great. I always love getting together with you guys and hashing out some of these stories. And this one here, this was a dandy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, cool. Folks, thanks for listening. And we'll try to get together probably in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That's what we've been doing, about 2 to 3 weeks. Yeah. So
same bad time, same bad channel.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks a lot, gang.
Now, back to The Rock on Damn Radio.
Back to The Rock. I love it.